Good to be here this morning and good to be back for a while. So now we can pick up some momentum and get things going, both in this class and in our class on Acts on Wednesday. We shouldn't have any interruptions for the next several months, I don't think. In fact, I know I won't be gone again until September, and so that should give us a time to get things going in these Bible studies. Of course, appreciate those who fill in when I'm away. We're really blessed here at Brown Street to have good men who do an outstanding job both in preaching and teaching, and so we certainly should be thankful for that. But as we continue in the Sermon on the Mount, we've seen the kingdom characteristics. We've just finished, if you're visiting with us, we've just finished the Beatitudes. And the Beatitudes, of course, again, tell us what kind of character we ought to have as citizens of the kingdom of God. And let's remind ourselves, as we just pick this up again, that this is a sermon from Jesus himself. And because of that, this is certainly the greatest sermon that we have record of. It's the most in-depth sermon that we have from Jesus. And so we know just going into it that it is going to be filled with rich material that's very needed and necessary, and that can help us with regard to our Christianity. And the biggest challenge, we have said from the start with the Sermon on the Mount, is not in understanding it. That is, of course, something we need to pay close attention to everything that we study and each text in the Sermon on the Mount. That's important. We want to be accurate in understanding the sermon itself. But really, when it's all said and done, it's not a real difficult sermon. That is to understand. It is difficult to apply because Jesus deals with life-changing things. And if we're really going to be what he wants us to be and what God wants us to be, then we have to stand ready to apply it to our lives. And that's the biggest challenge of all. And so we've gone through the Beatitudes themselves, these kingdom characteristics. We've learned that we have to be poor in spirit. We have to understand where we are spiritually without Christ. All of us are spiritually poor apart from Jesus. We have to make sure that we continue to have the right attitude towards sin. That is, that we mourn over sin, all kinds of sin, any kind of sin, that we mourn over it, whether it's our sin or the sin of brethren or even the sins of the world. We ought to mourn over it. We ought to be gentle or meek in spirit. We need to hunger and thirst, have that craving for righteousness. All of us should crave being right with God and doing right. That was the significance of that. Blessed, he says, are the merciful. We need to make sure that we're merciful, pure in heart, and peacemakers. And finally, that we are willing and ready to suffer for Christ if it comes to that. And it most certainly will if we're letting our light shine. And so those are the things that we've discussed over the last several months dealing with these Beatitudes. And now as we get into the rest of the sermon, it's really just the beginning. The Beatitudes just make up just the introduction. And so we're just really getting started. And we're going to deal, beginning with verse 13, the next section, goes down through verse 16. And we might refer to this particular passage as the testimony of the citizen of the kingdom. Two things he's going to introduce that really prove that we are what he wants us to be. Let's go ahead and read those verses. You are, he says, the salt of the earth. But if the salt has lost or has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Then he says, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men, so in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Both of those two things that he introduces are really very valuable and essential if we're going to be good Christians. So we're going to look this morning at that first one. Ye are the salt of the earth. And you stop and think about salt. What makes salt so valuable? Someone has said with regard to salt that there are over 14,000 uses for salt, and only 5% of that has to do with food. So you think, what? Why is salt so valuable? It is in the fact that there's so many uses of it. It's not because it's hard to find. It's not because there's a shortage of salt. We have plenty of salt, and so it's precious and valuable simply because of the power of it. And that is seen in all of these various uses of salt. 14,000 different uses for salt. So that's really the power of it. So what we want to do as we begin to look at this is look at many of the various uses of it. There was an illustration I came across before we really get into the body of it. It has to do with a king who brought his daughters in just simply because he wanted them to describe to him how much they loved him. And it seems like sort of a needy king. But his oldest daughter came in and said to her father, I love you more than all of the riches of the kingdom, all of the silver and gold and all of those kind of material things. I love you more than all of that. And, of course, that was impressive to the father. And so he commended her, praised her, complimented her publicly. And then he asked for the second daughter to come in, and she pretty much had the same kind of things to say, but she said, I love you more than all of the pomp and pleasure of the kingdom, all of the fun that's involved in being the daughter of the king, all of the balls and all of the expensive carriages and all of that, all the wonderful clothes that I'm able to wear, and I love you more than all of those kind of things. And the king was impressed with that as well, so praised her publicly. And then, of course, he called in the third daughter, and you might anticipate what she said. She simply said to her father, I love you more than salt. And he was kind of shocked by that. He was disappointed and scolded her and really embarrassed her publicly. And it happened to be that the chef was standing by and heard all of that, so he thought he'd teach the king a lesson. And all of that day, the meals that he served to the king, he made them all without salt. And the food was tasteless. The food was bland and terrible. And the king, of course, right away wondered what's going on. He knew he had an outstanding chef. And so he called the chef in, and the chef told him, well, I purposely withheld salt from all of the food because I wanted you to realize how much your youngest daughter loves you. And, of course, he got the message that salt is powerful. And it does many things. And without salt, there's all kind of problems. And so we'll look at some of these things that salt does. But let's understand how precious it is, not because, again, it's rare or anything like that, but just because of what it does. And as we think about these things, we can't forget. Jesus says, you are the salt of the world. And so we read the salt of the earth. And so we recognize the application here. Look at what salt does. First of all, salt has preserving power, and we understand that it is powerful in that way. Most of us know that in the days before refrigeration, that salt was used to preserve things, and of course that's very significant. And now we're the salt of what? We're the salt of the earth, and so we preserve things, don't we? It's really, you stop and think, why hasn't God sent his son back yet? And we know we can't really answer that. But don't we have a preserving effect upon this world in which we live as the salt of the earth? We should. And we do. There's little question about that. Proverbs chapter 14, verse 34 says, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. And that is true. I think all of us understand this society is not going in the right direction. In fact, I was in a conversation with somebody here not too long ago. You know, we think about some of the decisions that have been made here with regard to this country even last week with abortion and that sort of thing and the same-sex marriage and all of that. You think, boy, I tell you, it's this country of ours is going to fall. And how many of us doubt that, really, as Christians, that sooner or later, if the Lord doesn't come back first, that's going to happen? We've been a great country for a long time, a powerful country. And there's no kingdom that has ever been in existence, no earthly kingdom that has, of course, gone on forever. And so kingdoms come and go. They rise and fall. And the fact that we've been a strong empire, so to speak, for such a long time doesn't mean that we're going to continue in that way. And a lot of people think, a lot of Christians think, and even just Bible believers who think about this, believe that we're seeing the beginning of the fall of this great country because of the direction that we're going in morally. And there could be, I don't know anything about that. We don't, people just talk about that. We really don't know. But really the problem, isn't just limited to this country. The immorality that is now pervading this world is everywhere. You stop and think about it. Well, God is going to bring an end to this country because you can look back in time and homosexuality sort of has always been a sign of the inner immorality of a nation. And most empires begin to fall because of inner moral corruption. And that's true, except for it's not just America that's now beginning to legalize same-sex marriage. I read not too long ago, I think France was struggling with the same kind of thing, and it's really global, isn't it? And so if that says anything about anything, it would say that perhaps we're getting closer and closer to the end of the world. Now, obviously, I'm not up here saying that. I don't know. We might be here another 10,000 years or longer as an earth. But the moral corruption that's in this society is amazing. And there's no doubt that, as this proverb says, that it's righteousness that preserves a nation. And through the years, it has been the preserving power of Christians that has held back the wrath of God. And it doesn't take much when you think. You say, well, you know, we're just a few with regard to this world. That's true. But it doesn't take much. Turn over to Genesis chapter 18, and you remember, With regard to Abraham, you're familiar with this, I'm sure. Beginning at verse 16, God has determined to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And why is it that he was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah? Okay, so they became totally corrupt, didn't they? And so we know God has a history of this sort of thing. He doesn't take sin lightly, and Sodom and Gomorrah became so corrupt that there wasn't anybody righteous there, and so God determined to destroy it. But you remember this text and how it develops. It says, then the men rose up from there, and they looked down toward Sodom, and Abraham was walking with them to send them off. The Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do? And since Abraham was surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all nations of the earth will be blessed, for I have chosen him so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about. And the Lord said, the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry, which has come to me. And if not, I will know. And then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom, while Abraham was still standing beside the Lord. And Abraham came near, and he said, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you indeed sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of the earth deal justly? So the Lord said, if I find some 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare the whole place on their account. And so he begins just with 50. Now, 50 is not very many compared to all the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. But if there were just 50, he would spare the city. And then Abraham reasons with God, and it goes down and down. And as you read, I don't know if you're like me, as you read this, you almost feel a little uncomfortable for Abraham because he keeps going back and back and back. And what does he get down to? 10. If God would have found just 10 righteous people in Sodom and Gomorrah, he would have spared those cities. Just 10. So I'm saying to you, it doesn't take that much. And you look at us, we're few as Christians, but there's no doubt in my mind that all through the years we have had some preserving power with regard to the corruption of this world. And we need to continue to have that. We need to continue to live the way God wants us to live so that our righteousness shines forth and we continue to be like salt and have that preserving power. And certainly that is one of the powers of salt. Look over at Genesis chapter 6. We won't spend too much time on that. But Genesis chapter 6, again, we see that in every age, when righteousness is removed, that God acts. This, of course, is leading up to the great flood. It says, and now it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them. And the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. They took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. And then the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on earth in those days and also afterwards when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. And then the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on earth, and he was grieved in his heart. And the Lord said, I will not blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals, to creeping things, and to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of God. So we see, again, God has a history, doesn't he, with regard to that. He hates sin. And so we can believe that we have had some preserving power on the earth. We have acted like salt, but we need to continue to do that. Look at the second thing very quickly. Salt has flavoring power. Not only does it preserve, but it also flavors. We all know that, don't we? Anybody here like me? I love McDonald's fries. Anybody else like those things? They're wonderful. And sometimes I'll go out and go to someplace else and get some fries, and they perhaps weren't salted. They taste like they're not salted at all, and they're just terrible because salt flavors it. It's just what it does. And I once bought some peanuts. I love peanuts as well, nice salty peanuts. And sometimes, you know, they sell those things unsalted. And if you're like me and not very observant, sometimes you grab the wrong can, and I couldn't eat those things without salt. It's what salt does. A dash of salt adds flavor. And going back to that illustration of the king, that chef knew that. If he withheld the salt, the food wasn't going to taste very good. And I'm sorry for all of you who love health food and that sort of thing and don't eat salt, but it just tastes a little better, doesn't it, with salt. And that's what it does. It flavors. Isn't there a relation between that and us as Christians? That is what salt does. It brings the flavor out. We ought to be bringing the flavor, so to speak, the flavor out of the world. We ought to have a good influence on the world. And so to God, the world tastes a little better because of our influence upon people around us. And we ought to have that influence on the people that we come into contact with, and the people that you work with. We ought to bring the best out of people. And, of course, we can only do that. Now, with all of this, we can only do that if we're living the way God wants us to live. And later on now, if we lose our saltiness, what are we good for? Nothing but to be trodden under the foot of men. So we need to make sure that we have that power within us by living according to the gospel of Christ. But we ought to bring out the best of people. And we do that often. Have you ever noticed that if you're maybe where you work, if people really respect you. Now, we understand that this doesn't always happen. Some people are just determined to do wrong and are set in their ways no matter who they're around. But I have found often that if a Christian is around those who maybe cuss and curse, and they know that you're a Christian and they respect you because you've been living according to the gospel of Christ and they know your sincerity, they won't cuss and curse around you quite as much. They won't gossip. They won't tell the dirty jokes around you. And you're actually having, at least in that small realm, you're having an influence, a flavoring influence upon those around you. Now, again, sometimes the numbers are against you, and that emboldens those who are in sin. And so sometimes they don't care. They'll go ahead right around you and act the way they act. But a lot of times they won't, just because of the respect that they have for you. And there's the influence. And we should do that. People should act better around us if we let our light shine, if we continue to in a nice, humble, kind fashion, let people know where we stand and what we're about. That can have a flavoring, a good influence upon the people that we come in contact with. Now, the opposite of that is going to the job and just trying to get along with everybody and acting just like them. And when they see that you're not bothered at all by the bad jokes, or if God forbid, they hear you cussing and cursing right along with them, what kind of flavoring influence do you have if that happens? And sometimes we do that. We give in to the world. Remember what Paul said in Romans 12 and at verse 2? What shouldn't we conform to? To the world. Be not conformed to this world. We don't have to act like the world. We don't have to dress like the world. We certainly don't have to use the language of worldly people. So when you go off to work or to school or whatever, don't be so attached to the friendliness of the people around you and your desire to fit in and get along with your peers. Don't be too attached to that, to where you act just like them. We have to be a peculiar people. That's how, we'll get more into this next week, but that's how we let our light shine. There's a difference between a Christian and a non-Christian. How shameful is it if you can stand a Christian next to a non-Christian and you can't tell by the lives that they're living, you can't tell which is which? Or worse, mistake the non-Christian for the Christian. You don't ever want that to be you. There should be a distinction between us and people in the world because we're living by a higher standard, the Bible, the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so we have to continue to do that, not conform to the world, be different, and people will respect that. I can remember growing up, and most of you know my background. I wasn't a Christian growing up. I was a heathen, and my friends were heathens. But we had people around us when I, on the basketball team and other players, there were some who came from a religious background, and we'd make fun of them and joke about them and that sort of thing. But deep inside, we always had a respect for them. And if I was having some troubles or if I wanted to have a serious conversation about something, I wouldn't go to one of my heathen friends. They were just as knuckleheaded as me. They didn't know anything. And I would, if I was going to ask advice, it would be the one who claimed to be a Christian. And so inside, I respected those who live that kind of lifestyle. And it's the same thing in the world today. But you can't be hypocritical, and you can't be wishy-washy, and you can never bend and buckle when it comes down to the moral standard of the gospel of Christ. You can never compromise your values. You have to live the way you know God wants you to live. And that's a part of being the salt. It's the only way you can flavor anything, is if you walk the way God wants you to walk. And you'll have that, whether you realize it now or not, you'll have that influence on people that you work with and go to school with, family members who aren't Christians. You remember how Peter, with regard to the woman, the wife, how did he say she should win her husband? That's exactly right. But just by influence, not by nagging all the time and that sort of thing. Look at 1 Peter chapter 3 And the principle here certainly would be applicable to all of us and the converting of people to Christ. 1 Peter chapter 3 and at verse 1. It says, in the same way, you wives, and this, by the way, I don't want to get too much on an aside here, but all of this is dealing with the idea of being persecuted, but still living for Christ regardless of the situation that you're in. And he gives many examples of this. You live in a country, maybe this is more and more going to become applicable to us, but you live in a country when the government is not very good, the government is corrupt, what should you do? You still live for Christ. You know, we forget sometimes. In this country, when they're passing law, soon every state in this country will have legalized same-sex marriage. There's little doubt of that in my mind. There's some southern states that are going to hang on and fight a little bit more. But the fact of the matter is, soon this world is just going in that direction. Not just this country, the whole world. What in the world do we do with a government that is pushing and promoting homosexuality and pushing and promoting the brutality of abortion? Well, what do we do? There's no way that we can survive. Yes, there is. We forget when the Bible was written, the church was born into a corrupt government. I mean, they were, so far as morality is concerned, the world was a mess way back then. We always think today that morally speaking, where it's the worst it has ever been. Really, talk to Noah about that. The only difference today is that things are more open, and there's more media outlets in things, and so we have these kind of things that people coming out of the closet, so to speak, and all of that, and all the news and that sort of thing. But really, there's nothing new under the sun. Most of the Roman emperors were either homosexual or at least engaged in highly immoral activity. And that was the world that the Christians lived in, and the world that Peter was describing in this particular context. Back in chapter 2, he emphasized that. Verse 13, submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as one in authority or governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do right. And so he goes on to emphasize that even in that situation, a corrupt government, you live the way he wants you to live. Verse 18, he talks about servants submitting to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable. And so he's saying, you submit, learn to submit, learn to submit. And then he gives the greatest example of all, of Jesus. Jesus was willing to do the will of his Father, even when it meant he was going to be persecuted. And of course he was, even unto death. And Peter, of course, tells us in several places in his writings, follow in his steps. And then you get to chapter 3, and in chapter 3 he says, in the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives. This is one of the passages that's good to show that there is no justification for separation within a marriage, regardless of even if the husband doesn't always behave himself. How many times have I seen such marriages just fall apart because the wife thinks, well, my husband isn't loving me as Christ loved the church, therefore I don't have to submit to him. Is that true? No. You wives have to submit to your husbands no matter what, unless he's telling you to do something that's contrary to the gospel of Christ. You always put God first. And it goes the other way around. There are some husbands who would say, I don't have to love my wife because, you know, she's not very submissive. No, you husbands, you have a responsibility to love your wives as Christ loved the church, regardless of how your wife acts. You wives, you have the responsibility to submit regardless of how your husband acts. Those are just the principles set forth in the gospel of Christ. And I'm not saying there isn't anything you can do if things get out of control and there's physical abuse, that sort of thing. There's always measures to take, but I'm saying none of that is a cause for divorce, certainly. And in this very context is proof of that. After he talks about all these submissive relationship and abusive situations with regard to those who are in control, he says to the wives, in the same way you wives, you submit to your own husband. And then he indicates, even when they don't behave right. And you try to win them over, but how do you do it? Not by the nagging. You try to win them over by your behavior. Now, it's that principle that is true with all of us. He's talking about a specific thing here, but in every walk of life, how do we win these people in the world who have hard hearts and are living immoral lives? How do we win them to Christ? There obviously comes a time we have to open up our mouths and preach the gospel, as Philip did with the Ethiopian eunuch. But it all begins with your behavior. You have to be like salt. You have to have a flavoring influence upon the people around you by living sincerely and consistently for Christ. Then you can really make a difference. Look at C quickly. Salt has germ-killing power. And that is true. Salt does some things that I didn't realize that it could do. You can dissolve some salt in some water, and it helps kill the germs that cause sore throat. Now, I sort of knew that. You get a sore throat, you use salt sometimes to help that situation. But then I read somewhere a pinch of salt in the water of fresh-cut flowers will make them stay fresh longer. And I didn't know that. Some of you sisters probably knew that. I didn't know that. A little bit of salt in some water can remove stains on garments, can even make washing windows a little easier. And all of that points to the power of salt to fight against corruption. And we did. Do you think we need that in our society today? What kind of world do we live in? One, as we've said already, full of sin. David said, "Behold, I was shaped in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me." David saying he was born a sinner? No, he's not saying that at all. He's really saying there he was born into a world dominated by sin. That's all he's really saying there. A world where there's sin on every hand. And all these years later, as we've been talking about that, that hasn't gotten any better at all. There's a lot of corruption around us. But salt fights corruption. Salt can help. And we need to do all that we can to fight the corruption of the world. How do you think we do that? How can we be the salt and fight the corruption of the world? All right, by being obedient. That goes back to the same thing we've been talking about. By being obedient, there's the consistency. We have to have that. And we can do, there's all kind of corruption. There's moral corruption we need to fight against. But there's also doctrinal corruption, isn't there? And which means then now if we're going to fight corruption, we have to stand for the truth ourselves, don't we? Does doctrine matter? Oh, but we're living in a religious world that says doctrine doesn't matter at all. That's a part of the corruption with regard to doctrine. We have to make sure we stand for the truth. We fight against moral corruption, doctrinal corruption, any kind of corruption. We do all that we can to fight against it. And we certainly can do that if, as Kathy said, we have the consistency about us. Live the life and do it consistently and have the boldness to stand up and speak out. I remember the example of Enoch. You remember Enoch was, and what happened to Enoch? God took him. But before God took him, what kind of testimony did he have? He walked righteously before God. He pleased God, the King James said. That was his testimony. That was the testimony of his life. It wasn't simply what he said. Although, if you look at the few passages that talk about Enoch, he did a lot of talking. He did a lot of preaching. He preached against ungodliness on every hand, and he was living in a very ungodly world. But first, really, the testimony of his life was how he lived. He lived openly. He wasn't ashamed of who he was. He lived openly and people saw it. And so he pleased God. And so God took him. But that's what we need to do. Don't be ashamed of being a Christian. One of the things we'll get into next week just a little bit, I'll just mention it now. One thing about salt, it has all this power that we've talked about. It preserves, it flavors, it fights against corruption. But what does it do in the box? Nothing. Doesn't do any of that. You have to pour it out. It has to make contact. We can't be salt just sitting in this building. That's very important. We have to make contact with the world. And we'll get into that a little bit next week and look at six ways that we can be the salt of the earth. I appreciate your attention.